Fife.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the Court. John Pfeiffer on behalf of Appellant Capital Indemnity Corporation. Your Honor, this is an insurance coverage case that arises out of a 2003 raid by federal marshals upon Elston Self-Serve Grocery, in which raid they seized counterfeit Newport cigarettes. Lorillard Tobacco Company at that point filed a lawsuit alleging a fraudulent buy-down scheme as well as sale of counterfeit cigarettes. The underlying case does not allege advertising, but it is about the sale of counterfeit cigarettes. In order to trigger the insurance coverage under the capital indemnity policy, Elston asserted that there was coverage under the advertising injury coverage, which requires that Elston's advertising had caused Lorillard's potential injury, but that advertising injury coverage has an exclusion for any liability arising out of material first published before the policy period began.
And what is material?
It's the content of the publication, Your Honor.
The thing I wonder about is that trademark. There's a counterfeit trademark.
Yes, Your Honor. The material is the logo or the name or other content that's published. It is not whether that publishing was with Lorillard's permission or not. That is, Lorillard's permission determines whether something is infringing or not, but the content is the same. What is on the paper is the same, regardless of whether Lorillard gives permission or whether the particular name or logo or whatever is from an unauthorized source. And in fact, Lorillard can make something to be non-infringing after it's published, if it gives permission after the fact for the publishing.
And mostly, though, we're talking about the first publication issue and evidence of when this trademark first appeared, or at least what is before the court, this counterfeit.
Your Honor, the lower court found, and the parties don't dispute, that Elston's advertising was the same for 20 years before and during the policy period.
But I'm not talking about the advertisement. That's what I'm trying to focus on here, is that there was something distinguishing the legal from the illegal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In order to get coverage under capital indemnity's policy, Elston must prove that its advertising caused the supposed Lorillard advertising injury. So whatever Elston only asserts two activities which it asserts triggered the policy, but both of those, it's undisputed, were the same for 20 years.
There's not any difference. There's no evidence that they were distributing counterfeits for 20 years, is there?
No, Your Honor. But it is undisputed that what was published, the substance or the content of the advertising, was the same for 20 years.
I guess I just if it's all focused only on the advertising and the same advertising they've done for 20 years, then you're saying that was been there a long time and it wasn't first published, and therefore it's the exception.
Your Honor,
I'm only trying to see if there is a distinction. The evidence before the court, and I look at it because it says it's arising out of oral or written publication of material whose first publication. And you're saying material is all about advertising and nothing about what could be a counterfeit trademark.
It's all about the content of the advertising. It is an exclusion concerning the advertising injury coverage, and the advertising injury coverage says that there is coverage for certain advertising injury unless it arises out of material first published before the policy period.
And that's all I'm wondering, if that trademark was, if there is evidence that there's no such thing as a counterfeit trademark. Well, you're right. I'm trying to figure out what distinguishes with somebody, even an expert looking at the pack or whatever, wherever this, whatever you sell, is different than if this is stuff that's going to only be sold overseas, with not taxed or something like that, right?
Thank you, Your Honor. The difference between the trademarks published by Lorillard and the trademarks published by this unauthorized source is who ran the press. Even Lorillard's own packaging expert could not tell the difference between the trademarks on the counterfeit and the trademarks on the genuine cigarettes, much less could the public tell any difference.
Well, is there any difference?
The only difference was who ran the press.
What?
The only difference was whether the particular publishing was authorized or not. It had only to do with whether there was permission. It had nothing to do with the content being the same. The content was indistinguishable.
Well, I guess that's a pretty good counterfeit. Nobody can tell the difference.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe when they light up, they could. I don't know.
Well, the way that Lorillard's packaging... I'm sorry?
Now I'm lost. I don't understand how the trademark infringement claim has anything to do with who printed the packs. Has to do with who made the contents of the packs.
The trademark infringement was the unauthorized use of Lorillard's trademarks. And so the trademarks were indistinguishable to even Lorillard's packaging experts. The way that they
trademark claim as if it were a copyright claim, and it's not.
Your Honor, what was published was the very trademark of Lorillard Tobacco Company.
Yes. I can publish the trademark Newport anytime I want. I can stamp it on my wall. I can make a poster of it. I just can't use it in connection with cigarettes that aren't actual Newport cigarettes. That's the difference between copyright and trademark law. Now, I don't think anything here turns on it, but we should understand the difference between copyright and trademark principles.
Thank you, Your Honor. What is at issue here is Elston's publishing of those trademarks in the bootleg cigarettes without those trademarks being authorized on those cigarettes. The only way that Lorillard could tell the difference, its own packaging experts could tell the difference between the counterfeit cigarettes and the real genuine Lorillard cigarettes, was a 3/8 inch difference in the cellophane tape that opens the top, the pull tab.
Okay. And that's the only difference.
Well, and out of sequence coating that talked about freshness and so on. And also, Lorillard deliberately fuzzes a few numbers on genuine cigarettes, code numbers on genuine cigarettes, as another indication to itself what it's genuine. But even the trademarks were indistinguishable to the Lorillard packaging experts. And every bit of the counterfeit Newport packages were indistinguishable to the public. So they gave the same message. And the product identification was the same. And the lower court found, and none of the parties dispute, that the advertising was the same for 20 years.
Is there a reason why we are talking in this case about these handbills? Does Lorillard's complaint in the underlying state litigation make anything of the handbills?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, they don't. And this is why they're talked about at all. Elston had a problem trying to fit this case, the underlying case, into its advertising injury coverage. So it raised two and only two possible advertisings.
Right. I understand there are these handbills and then the point of sale ads.
Yes.
And since coverage depends on what's alleged in the underlying complaint, and the underlying complaint doesn't make anything of the handbills, it seems to me we need to focus on the point of sale materials. whether that's covered by the advertising injury.
Your Honor, if no one considers the flyers, then that leaves Elston only one of two possible advertising activities from which it could trigger coverage. That's fine with capital indemnity.
Focus on that.
Second of all, the underlying complaint is relevant to triggering the capital indemnity policy by the timing of when it alleges the advertising injury offense occurs. However, the capital indemnity first publication exclusion has nothing to do with when the advertising injury offense occurred. It has to do with whether there was prior publishing of the same material. This is just like the underlying...
In the underlying complaint, Lorillard makes nothing of the handbills, then when the handbills were first published can't possibly matter to coverage. Coverage has to depend on the point of sale material.
Fine, then there's only one advertising injury.
Yes, but I'm trying to get you to discuss whether the policy covers that, and so far I have not been successful.
Sorry, Your Honor. The second of the purported advertisings that Elston alleges trigger the advertising injury coverage is the label on the cigarette packages themselves. However, those labels were indistinguishable and gave the same message for 20 years. They're indistinguishable from the genuine packages. And so as advertising, they're identical. The content is identical. There's no difference that could be discerned, and that's the whole point of advertising.
Now it sounds like it sounds like you're just taking issue with our conclusion that these kinds of policies cover trademark infringement. The only focus of trademark infringement is the difference between the mark and the actual manufacturer of the product. The mark isn't actionable in the abstract, right? That was the point I was making about the difference between trademark and copyright. Mark is never actionable in the abstract. What's actionable is the difference between the mark and the actual producer of the product. Now, are you saying that actually Judge Mannion asked this question. Are you saying that they've been selling counterfeits for 20 years? And your answer is no.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the problem arises not with the mark in the abstract, but with the fact that it's not matched to the genuine product. And if that didn't precede your policy, then I don't see where we're going.
Well, the trademarks as published, as disseminated by Elston, handing out cigarettes over the counter at the checkout or whatever, those trademarks, that dissemination of that material is the same other than the unauthorized source.
Maybe I'm just not making any impression.
I'm sorry.
A trademark is actionable when it is a false claim of origin. Handing out a pack with the mark Newport on it is a perfectly true claim of origin if there are Newport cigarettes inside. It's a false claim of origin if it's not. The thing that Lorillard is complaining about in the underlying litigation is handing out, and point-of-sale signs, but handing out packs with a representation that what's inside this pack is a genuine Newport cigarette. Right? And that's a different representation if it's genuine than if it's not.
And the content of that representation was the same for 20 years. That is, the same representation that these are Lorillard cigarettes was the same for 20 years, even if it was wrong at one point and not wrong for another point. That is, wrong at one time period and not wrong at another time period. The content was, the representation was the same.
You have to show, I guess, is that this is pre-existing, and I guess I'm just not getting I guess you're saying everything was pre-existing, and whatever they're alleging doesn't matter. Whatever
we're saying that
I guess the only thing I guess as far as the content is what's in the pack is the I assume the cigarettes are the same. They're just supposed to be sold overseas or something. Now, maybe they're not the same. I don't know. I fortunately never smoked.
Yes. Your Honor, the trademark representation that it's the same was that representation was the same for 20 years.
Yeah,
that representation that these are Newport cigarettes, that representation was the same for 20 years, even if it was false at one point.
Well, there was
not
a point when it wasn't. It was a false representation, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but the representation itself was the same for 20 years.
Well, they were saying it was true at one point and false at another time. And when did it become false? And what do we have before the court to know when it became false? And does that matter as far as an advertising entry? Or are you saying that's something else? It's not an advertising entry.
What we're saying is that the publishing of that representation was the same for 20 years, even if that representation was true at one point and not true at another point. The content of that representation was the same.
That's where you're losing me, because the representation, at least on the pack at the point of sale, is a representation that these cigarettes in particular are Newports. The statement made 10 years ago was not that these cigarettes in particular are genuine Newports. It was that those cigarettes sold 10 years ago were Newports. Was there a representation made 10 years ago that these cigarettes being sold now are Newports? I can't imagine how that representation was made.
The representation was of the identical content.
No, because the cigarettes are different. That's the problem, right? The trademark representation is that this stuff, the contents of this pack, is cigarettes, is Newport cigarettes. And I don't see how something sold in connection with a pack, even one day ago, could be a representation about the contents of this package.
Your Honor, we believe that the published material being the same, even if it's just like an ad for Pepsi printed in two different newspapers, that it's the same representation made in two different newspapers. This is the same representation about Newport cigarettes made on two different packages. It's the content that's the same. And it's the content being the same that is the focus of the first publication exclusion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ayers.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Pfeiffer. Steve Ayers on behalf of the insured in this case. I'll start out by saying I think that Your Honor's picking up on the point of sale as being the important aspect of this case is a significant one. And that and there's no question that the point of sale vis-a-vis the underlying complaint filed by Laura Lardon in this case was during the policy period under which coverage is sought.
Right. But for you, the big question is that advertising?
Your Honor, that was an issue which was briefed in the trial court. There is case significant, and in fact the majority of the cases hold that it is. Coastaline, I was a little worried that in their reply brief they might get into whether it's advertising injury in the first instance. I don't think that is really the issue that they have raised before this court. I felt that in an effort to be safe on it, I would submit some of those cases in our brief. And I think the abundance of case law is that the packaging on the cigarettes themselves satisfies the advertising injury requirement. Both prongs of the requirement, misappropriation of advertising ideas or style of doing business, and infringement of copyright, title, or slogan. But again, I do not believe that issue is before this court as an issue raised from the trial court's memorandum opinion. So I don't think this court needs to even address that issue in this appeal. As you know, the trial judge in this case issued a comprehensive opinion, and I believe, and it's 26 pages long, it addressed that type of issue, But the only issue that Capital has raised in this appeal is the applicability of this first publication exclusion. And I think they face significant and unsurmountable legal and factual hurdles in trying to assert the applicability of that exclusion. From a legal point of view, I'd like to stress that what we're talking about here is the duty to defend. It's not the duty to indemnify, but it's the duty to defend under Illinois law. And I won't belabor the fact that Illinois law is extremely liberal with respect to determining a duty to defend. If there's a potential for coverage, then there's a duty to defend, and we'll address the indemnity issue at some later time. Especially when you're dealing with an exclusion like the first publication exclusion. If that exclusion is susceptible to more than one interpretation, under Illinois law, it's ambiguous and has to be construed against Capital. We've cited a case, Maddox, which addresses that very issue, and the judge there comes to the conclusion that it is subject to multiple interpretations, one of which is that material for purposes of the exclusion pertains to infringing material. It has nothing to do with prior non-infringing material. Under Illinois general coverage principles, I don't think Capital has a leg to stand on. But even more important is the authority with respect to the exclusion itself. You'll note from the briefs that Capital has cited no authority whatsoever in support of the applicability of the exclusion as they would have this court rule. And in fact, as set forth in our brief, all the cases which have addressed the issue have determined that it is not applicable, that you have to, if in a situation like this where there's no evidence or allegation of actionable trademark violation or actionable misconduct which predates the policy. And that's the instance we have here. And, in fact, Mr. Pfeiffer concedes as such that this litigation arose out of a raid that occurred in 2003 when the policy was in effect. There's no evidence. And, in fact, in their reply brief, they concede that there was no counterfeiting or allegations of or evidence of any counterfeit cigarettes being owned by my client, much less being sold by my client prior to the date of this policy. I know you're aware of the language, and I'd like to, if there's one thing I'd like to highlight in this case, it's the language of this exclusion itself. It excludes coverage for advertising, and I'm quoting, advertising injury arising out of oral or written publication of material whose first publication took place before the beginning of the policy period. I would suggest that since material is not defined in the policy, that a reasonable interpretation, and in fact the only reasonable interpretation in light of the purpose of the exclusion as set forth in Maddox and by this court in Taco Bell, is that it applies to actionable material, actual counterfeit cigarettes at the point of sale, as Your Honor noted. I would suggest that you could cross out material in the context of this particular case and insert counterfeit Newport cigarettes. And if you were to do that, it would require, for the exclusion to apply, would require that the counterfeit Newport cigarettes be published by Elston prior to the date of this policy. And as I mentioned, there's no allegation or evidence that that took place.
Is the point of that first publication that, and I'm just asking from your point of view at least, the first publication meaning that when they issued the insurance policy, they weren't aware of what they were insuring or were, I mean, they presumed what occurred before was what they were insuring. So within that space, first publication, this surprise or something, say, hey, we didn't insure that.
I think that's getting to exactly the point I would like to make in terms of the purpose of the exclusion, Your Honor, which is noted in Maddox and echoed in by this court in Taco Bell, is to prevent an insured who is engaging in ongoing wrongful conduct, for instance, trademark violations, hypothetically, and not in this case, if the insured had been trafficking in counterfeit cigarettes for years prior to the issuance of the policy. The policy is to not allow that insured to purchase insurance so as to subsidize that course of misconduct. And I would challenge Mr. Pfeiffer in rebuttal to come up with any other purpose for that exclusion. There are several exclusions in a policy that are similar: intentional acts, known losses, damage to property, which is in the care, custody, and control of the insured. They're known as moral exclusions. And insurance doesn't provide coverage for those traditionally because the risk is in the control of the insured. They can't underwrite the risk because the insured controls the risk. In this particular case, they are trying to use the language of this exclusion basically to say, we're insulated by virtue of your legitimate activities. You're selling legitimate Newports prior to the policy that didn't violate any trademark. That immunizes us from needing to provide any coverage whatsoever to you should you run into the unfortunate circumstances that arose here. Looking at, if I were an insurance company looking at that generating premiums from that point of view and underwriting that type of risk, I would charge nothing for a premium because the coverage they would purport to give would be completely illusory.
So it's the point of sale, the fact that it's, we'll call it counterfeit, whatever we're describing this, is first discovered during this policy period. We don't know what went on before. We presume it wasn't. That's what the insurer would presume. So this is the first time this occurs. So I'm wondering what then if that's is it the pack itself? Is that or is that not advertising?
The pack itself is advertising, Your Honor, and that is something that the trial court found that is not being challenged before.
Okay,
this
so the fact that the pack is counterfeit and it's only discovered at least in this time period. I guess I'm trying to figure out. Okay, now how does this apply or not apply? I'm just a little bit having trouble trying to focus on exactly what we look for in the record.
Well, I would look for one thing in particular, and that is we have the admission in their reply brief and, in fact, before you that there's no evidence of any prior publication that was actionable, no prior publication of any counterfeit cigarettes. Everything was during the policy period, the first marketing or advertisement of these allegedly counterfeit cigarettes was during the policy period. And then I would turn to the exclusion itself and the word material. And I would submit that Your Honor could cross out material and insert what the context of this underlying case deals with, which is counterfeit Newport cigarettes. And if you were to do that, the exclusion would read that it only excludes coverage for damages arising out of the prior publication of that material, i.e., those counterfeit cigarettes. There's no allegation. There's no evidence of that prior publication. Your Honor, I have not used up my full allotment of time, but unless you have any other specific questions. I agree. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Pfeiffer?
Yes, Your Honor, just briefly.
Elston and the lower court are treating the first publication exclusion as if it were the same as the Ranger Insurance first wrongful publication exclusion. We cite and quote the Ranger Insurance case on page 17 of our principal brief. That word makes a big difference, and that is not the coverage that's provided by our policy. Our policy provides advertising injury coverage except unless the claim arises out of material first published before the policy period, not for the first wrongful publication of that content before the policy period. One further thing, Your Honors. As one further indication that the lower court and Elston misunderstand the Taco Bell case, besides confusing the concepts of risk materializing and loss materializing as set forth in our principal briefs, the lower court rules that the first publication exclusion doesn't apply unless the injury was the same. But that would mean that the applicability of the exclusion could never be determined in the coverage suit because that would resolve that material issue. Yet the Taco Bell case shows that it can be. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.